People of the United States who support me, who help me, who show me this sport, who brought me here. I'm running for the refugees, and I'm running for the South Sudan in special, you see. So those are the three groups and all the supporters.
Marial is running under the Olympic flag as his country of South Sudan wasn't recognized at the time of his qualifying for the Olympics, and he refused to run under the flag of Sudan. Several U.S. Olympians have a chance to medal today. Women gymnasts Gabby Douglas and Ali Reisman will compete for gold in the all-around competition in swimming. It's Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps facing off in the men's 200-meter individual medley. And Missy Franklin hopes to win a second gold medal in the 100-meter freestyle in the Summer Games in London. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ancestry.com, for people to discover family history that didn't get passed down from grandma. Learn more at TryAncestry.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In the 1920s and 1930s, the leading physicists of the world were intent on exploring the world on the subatomic level. And then came along World War II and the Cold War and the space race. And that ended up pushing physics into a much more pragmatic direction, understandably so. And it might have stayed there if not for a group of eccentrics from Berkeley who brought a sense of discovery back to the field and with it a return to the mysteries of the quantum world. In this hour of Focus, we will be getting the story as we talk with MIT professor David Kaiser about his book, How the Hippies Saved Physics. The subtitle of the book is Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. And it is published by W.W. Norton. And it's quite an interesting story. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, David Kaiser. He's professor of the history of science and also department head of MIT's program in science, technology, and society. He is also a senior lecturer in MIT's Department of Physics. In his historical research, he focuses on the development of physics in the U.S. during the Cold War, particularly looking at how it evolved at the intersection of politics and culture and the changing shape of higher education. In his scientific work as a physicist, he's interested in early universe cosmology. He has been published. His work has been featured in a lot of popular publications, things like Harper's, Nature, Science, Scientific American. Also, he's been featured on National Public Radio, and his scientific work has been published in specialist journals in physics and history. And Professor Kaiser, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, uh-huh. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
All right, good. Well, you know, I found the story really fascinating. I was a psychology undergrad in the early 70s, a little late to the party, but yeah. Was, like a lot of people, was very interested in how psychology and philosophy and Eastern mysticism were all getting tangled up with one another. I guess I didn't really, though, appreciate at the time how science, and maybe one of the hardest of the hard sciences, physics, was actually getting tangled up with all these other things as well.
Yep, no, that was a fun part that I enjoyed discovering, delving into as well, working on the book.
Maybe the thing to do would be to start to do, I guess it's my failing to think of things chronologically, and maybe to start, though, to talk a little bit about the 20s and the 30s and some of the physicists whose names we know, Einstein and Bohr and Heisenberg and people like that. What were the questions that really that fascinated them?
Well, there were a lot of questions. And among them were, how to make sense of these, increasingly bizarre-seeming equations they were finding. And so they wanted to understand sort of the nature of cause and effect, the behavior of forces in the natural world, And the apparatus that they had developed and their predecessors had developed, really going back to the age of Galileo and Newton, they just started giving increasingly bizarre-sounding answers. They just didn't seem to add up the same way when they were being applied to sort of the physics of atoms or the parts of atoms, the physics of the very small. Mm. And so so what they began to come up against, and not always very happily, was that some very seemingly core notions about, again, cause and effect, or it was often called determinism. If we knew everything we could know about the objects in the world right now, could we predict with certainty what will happen at some later time? The failure of that notion was really a sticking point, and that came along with other conceptual kind of puzzles as well. Famously, things like wave-particle duality are the stuff, the basic building blocks of the world. Are they more like particles, like, say, you know, ping pong balls shrunk down to small size, or are they more like waves? Are they spread out in space? Do they interfere with each other? Do they have these other strange properties? And the answer seemed clear enough when dealing with waves on the ocean versus baseballs around us in the kind of everyday scales. But the answers got kind of mixed together in, again, very surprising, unexpected ways when trying to apply those equations to the very small, to the physics of atoms or parts of atoms. And so those are the kinds of things that the greats of the 1920s and 30s, people like Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, that whole generation, and that's what they spend a lot of their time really banging their heads against.
Mm-hmm. So then we come along to World War II. And for the field of physics, it seems that the priority has really shifted. They had to set aside the kind of mystical stuff about what was going on at the subatomic level because they were interested in winning the war. And then we had the Cold War, and then we had the space race. And that really, you suggest, explain that really changed at least for a while, changed the way that physics was going.
It did, and it's important to say it's not a good-bad. It wasn't that it was a trade-off that it suddenly became sort of bad physics. Quite the contrary. This was the era, especially in the United States, after World War II, when physics in the United States really sort of came, in many ways, came into its prime. And if you look at, say, count up the numbers of Nobel Prizes or just, you know, astonishingly important work that got done. So it wasn't good-bad, but what it was a kind of shift in priorities or in styles. And so the kind of late night, was it all mean kind of discussion that really had literally kept up Einstein, Bohr, and their colleagues, it kept them up all night, banging their heads against these sort of juicy philosophical questions. That style really was marginalized, was pushed out the door. And the sort of semi-joking phrase became shut up and calculate. You know, your job is to figure out how the world works so we can apply it to increase our knowledge of kind of real-world systems. Mm-hmm. It's in that setting that physicists conquered, really, for the first time, an understanding of superconductivity. That's a great mystery of matter. It's not merely mousetrap engineering, and so on. But the idea was to sort of put the equations to work, apply them to a wide range of phenomena, but not to ask that kind of, wait a minute, the big metaphysical, what does it all mean kind of question. And so that was a kind of stylistic trade-off that really did seem to harden during and especially and then after World War II.
Yeah, and as one certainly might well expect, because of the World War II, the Cold War, the space race, this was, for a while at least, this was really great for the field of physics in the sense that there was tremendous demand for people who were trained in physics. So if you could get into graduate school and get yourself a PhD in physics, you could expect that when you got out, you should have pretty good job opportunities.
Absolutely right. In fact, this was the first time, really, certainly in the United States, when a career in physics became a kind of really well-paying, you know, a ticket to a comfortable life, to a comfortable, normal, middle-class life. And grad students at the time knew that. And look at advertisements in the trade journals. They lavish attention on how you can get your training in physics and then, you know, get a very good, very well-paying job and sort of live a happy, comfortable, and as I used to say, normal life, quote-unquote normal life. Mm-hmm. So it really was, in many ways, golden years by some measures for the field. But there were these sort of unspoken trade-offs that weren't quite noticed at the time. And again, I think those have to do with kind of styles of physics. What types of questions were getting traction, were attracting new students, were being written about in the new textbooks and so on.
Mm-hmm. So here, that really, in a sense, that's all prologue to the story that you tell, because the story really picks up at this point. So it's, say, early 1970s, and you're looking particularly at a group of people, young physicists, who had all been in graduate school working on their degrees in physics at the point when literally the bottom fell out of the physics market.
That's exactly right. And so these were folks, by and large, the ones who became central to my story. They had entered graduate school, many of them sort of right after this sort of Sputnik boom. Enrollments were climbing through the roof. Funding was plentiful. Jobs were even more plentiful for young physicists or engineers and other nearby fields. And these folks were going to some of the nation's most elite PhD programs. They were being trained exquisitely well at places like Columbia and Berkeley and Stanford and UCLA and so on. Really just the top programs, among the top programs. And then, as you say, they had the misfortune to sort of wrap up their PhDs when the bottom fell out, when the physics suffered an unbelievable reversal of fortunes by any measure that you count, by funding for basic research, by the number of jobs available, and then eventually even by, say, the enrollments, by the number of students taking the classes. They all went through an amazing crash between the late 60s and really early 1970s. And so the folks about whom I wound up focusing or writing about, you know, they were getting their PhDs and then entering a kind of non-existent job market, which was true for thousands and thousands of PhD-holding physicists, you know, around the nation. And so they kind of scraped by, and they had some very surprising kind of accidental journeys. That the way they would have to make a life in physics was, no matter what else, would have to be different from what had been kind of the norm or had seemed taken for granted just maybe 10 or 15 years earlier.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just again introduce, is David Kaiser. He's professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he teaches in the program in Science, Technology, and Society and the Department of Physics. And we're talking about the story that you can read about in his recent book. It's titled How the Hippies Saved Physics. The subtitle is Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival, published by W.W. Norton. Well, you know, given, again, the fact that you talked about how these people who were training in some of the top programs in physics in the country in different places all ended up in the Bay Area.
They did. And you know, it was it might look obvious in hindsight, but at the time, as far as I can reconstruct it, they really were, you know, each story was different. There were about 10 of these sort of central figures whom I wound up really focusing on. And, you know, it was the accidents of life, the sort of bumbling along, where, as I say, they came to this kind of fork in the road professionally, most of them did, where just going on in, say, academic physics was not going to be a straightforward proposition. And I should clarify, you know, by 1971, there were more than 1,000 young physicists registered with a kind of placement service competing for just 53 jobs on offer, 1,000 to 50.
Wow.
That's the kind of, you know, numbers we're talking about. And so physics really, the career paths were going to sort of splay out in different patterns. And so indeed, these folks kind of, through different happenstance, with no real forethought, they kind of make their way to the Bay Area. And there they began to find each other. And that's when the story sort of picks up. They were some of them were unemployed, others were kind of underemployed, certainly for PhD-level scientists. I mean, some of them were for a time working as hotel porters, you know, that kind of thing, really some of them really scraping by. And they founded this little informal discussion group. They called themselves the Fundamental Physics Group, and they spelled physics with an F because they were being very playful. And they realized that each of them had these really deep passions for the kind of grand mysteries of modern physics, the types of questions that really had kept Einstein and Bohr and Heisenberg and all of them, active and on the edges of their seats back in the 1920s and 30s. But then it really kind of pushed out of the mainstream physics by the time these folks, the ones who wound up in Berkeley, when they were doing their own physics training that wasn't in their textbooks, it wasn't on their problem sets, when they were students. And they figured they had time on their hands. They were not pursuing a kind of standard career path by that point, not entirely by their choosing. But they were still, you know, deeply curious and really very passionate about these sort of grand mysteries of quantum theory. So they made this informal discussion group, and they met every Friday afternoon for for a couple hours, and then they kept that up for almost 4 years.
Our guest in this part of Focus, again, I'd like to introduce us, David Kaiser. He's a professor at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He teaches there in the program in Science, Technology, and Society, also in the Department of Physics. And we're talking about what you will find in a recently published book that he has authored. The title of the book is How the Hippies Saved Physics, and the subtitle is Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. W.W. Norton is the publisher. If you'd like to be involved in the conversation, that's really easy to do. You can pick up the telephone and call 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You can also send an email if you'd like to do it like that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, there's one important idea here that these physicists were very much interested in. And here that gets to the point where I start my mind, which is easily boggled, gets pretty boggled.
Right.
And this was something that, an idea that had been around for a while, although perhaps hadn't gotten an enormous amount of attention within the field of physics. And it was named for an Irish physicist named John Bell, whose idea it was. This was Bell's theorem. So as simply as you can explain it, what is Bell's theorem?
Sure. Yeah, so Bell's theorem, it has other nicknames too. Sometimes we call it entanglement or quantum non-locality. So I'm not sure those will make it more clear for your listeners, but those are other names they might have heard. And the idea in a nutshell is that quantum theory, again, can behave really very differently than our intuitions might suggest. And Bell put his finger on one of these and really pushed to see how far the equations of quantum theory really, you know, could be taken. So the idea is he imagined two particles, a pair of particles, that were shot out from some source. It could be a radioactive decay or certain types of atoms. In fact, it's not a very exotic way to produce these kinds of pairs of particles. So we have a certain kind of origin, and one particle shoots off to the left, and the other particle shoots off to the right. And the question that Bell posed, as indeed others like Einstein had posed beforehand, was what would happen if a physicist chose to measure some property of that particle that happened to shoot off to the left? Let's say that particle, we'll call it particle A, is shooting toward the physicist, and she has some apparatus and she can measure some property of that particle. It could be any number of things, pretty mundane properties of particle, nothing too fancy as far as physics is concerned. And the question that Bell wondered about was what would happen to that partner particle, the twin, that had gone off, say, in the right direction. And what he found in really a very elegant, very brief and elegant few pages of this article was that at least if we believe the equations of quantum mechanics, as physicists otherwise already had them, no new equations to bring to bear, then it suggested that if the physicist's choice to measure something on that particle A, the one that had gone off to the left, that could instantaneously change the properties that would be found on the other particle, on that twin particle, even if that other particle were, you know, a galaxy away. And this was really not supposed to happen. This seems to fly in the face of what we understand just from ordinary experience, or even more fancy in terms of Einstein's relativity and the speed of light being some sort of upper speed limit. It doesn't make any sense. It certainly didn't on the face of it to suggest that these two objects could share a kind of connection, even if they were arbitrarily far apart, and that connection could operate instantly, even faster than light, even faster than any other imaginable kind of influence or force. And so that's why it's often called entanglement. These particles, this pair of particles, A and B, can share this kind of single quantum-like state, even though they are in space, you know, very, very far apart. And so it starts to sound pretty spooky. In fact, Albert Einstein had an inkling of that notion. He hated it. He thought this was one more reason why quantum theory just had to be really revised. And he made fun of that notion. He called it spooky action at a distance. And that was not meant to be, you know, a term of praise.
Hmm. So what's interesting here is that apparently this idea today gets a lot of attention. People talk about it and think about it. But when Bell published this in the mid-60s, it didn't really get much attention. And when it did, the people really who were writing about it were mostly members of this Berkeley group.
Exactly right. And again, it sort of boggles the mind for what we know about physics today, or even what we know about, say, the best textbooks and what even our undergraduate physics majors learn about in their ordinary quantum theory courses now. Bell's theorem is page one, you know, of our latest textbooks. This crazy notion has been tested now, you know, in increasingly ingenious ways to increasing accuracy. And despite John Bell's own hopes, he hoped this would be a way of showing that quantum theory really wasn't the final answer. He thought this was also too bizarre that we had to test it to see if these strange things really were true. And despite John Bell's kind of private hopes, this notion, Bell's theorem, has been borne out time and time and time again to extraordinary accuracy. And yet, just as you say, this was really, really marginal stuff when it was first published. Bell published in a very, very obscure, little-known journal. It was not a mainstream journal by any measure. And then about 2 or 3 years after he published his article, the journal folded. That didn't help. You know, so the days before the Internet, things really could get lost in the archives or lost in the libraries. And so if you go through and see who were the people who did notice this very elegant but sort of out-of-the-way paper by John Bell, overwhelmingly, in those early years, they were members of this kind of ragtag discussion group that was meeting in Berkeley called the Fundamental Physics Group, and they dominated worldwide publications for the first 15 years after Bell's article had come out. And in fact, if you look at the few other articles that were on the topic and go track them down in the library, read them, you'll see in the acknowledgments, more often than not, they're thanking members of this Berkeley group if the article wasn't written by those members themselves. Mm-hmm. They really were we might call them the early adopters on Bell's theorem. And again, you can see why this is one of these sort of juicy nuggets of what does it all mean about the world, the kind of question that had drawn these folks in the Berkeley group, had drawn them into physics, and that they hadn't seen treated in their formal training, but they figured, you know, that's exactly what they should spend their kind of leisure time on by the mid-1970s.
Yeah, and here where it gets interesting and also wacky, I guess, is that among the things that the members of this Berkeley group were interested in, and certainly a lot of other people at the time in the Bay Area and, you know, around the country were interested in, was parapsychology. And there were people who were really thinking seriously about the possibility of things like telepathy and psychokinesis and things that might today and even then might have been dismissed as pseudoscience. And they said, well, look, if Bell's theorem really is right, that maybe that could actually explain these other things. I mean, if it's really possible for there to be this entanglement at this very, very basic level, that maybe things like telepathy are real and are possible, and that Bell's theorem could actually explain how that could work.
That's right. Again, this was sort of fascinating for me to dig into when I was working on the book. I wasn't a direction I expected to find the story to go. But we have to put our heads back to the early 1970s or mid-1970s, and especially to the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's where the range of activities that would later be kind of called New Age or occult, that they were really having their kind of, that was the epicenter, at least in the United States, in that time period. The kind of hippie counterculture was merging very distinctly, especially in Berkeley and the wider Bay Area, with what we now call the kind of occult or New Age kind of awakening, which was all about, you know, on the one hand, like crystal healing and stuff like that, and astrology, UFOs, but also mind reading and ESP and all that kind of stuff, clairvoyance and psychokinesis, just like you say. And again, this was stuff where it was being covered in the mainstream local newspapers, let alone the kind of underground press. The San Francisco Chronicle would run front page articles about experiments that were being conducted in the area at a place called the Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. SRI was a very prestigious, elaborate laboratory. They mostly did kind of defense contractor laboratory research. It had until recently been part of Stanford University, and it was spun off during the very active anti-Vietnam War protests on campus. This was seen as a defense lab. It didn't belong on campus, and it was part of a real trigger point, actually, for campus protest. So it had been spun off around roughly 1970 or so. And then they had a sort of budget cutbacks like everyone else when these sort of huge cutbacks started to hit physics. And so a few researchers there, again, very well-trained PhDs, one had written a textbook on quantum electronics, some of them began conducting laboratory tests on things like ESP or more broadly parapsychology. And some of those would be reported in the San Francisco Chronicle and the Examiner, and then in increasingly kind of far out venues. As we now know, that work was being bankrolled by the CIA and the Pentagon and some private donors as well. And so the fact that the Berkeley discussion group, or the members of that fundamental physics group, the fact that many of them got curious about parapsychology, some became curious but openly skeptical, but figured there's something going on here, we should investigate it. Others, at least for a time, became pretty convinced that there was something real there, and then they would kind of oscillate back and forth. But they figured this is, like you say, this is weird. It certainly is, but so is quantum theory. And they might be weird in very similar ways. And in fact, if there's anything to these laboratory tests, they were done by competent people. They looked like they were, you know, repeatable and all that. It looked like a real scientific laboratory effect. Then someone had better explain it. And their job, they figured, was to reason through, to puzzle through these real strange features of quantum theory, Bell's theorem highest among them, to try to say, could we understand, if the world acts that way, can we understand it with what we know about modern physics?
Hmm. We're about at a midpoint in the conversation here. We'll take a very short break. This is Focus.
To the women who say they are not feminists, Catelyn Moran asks,
what part of liberation for women is not for you? Is it the freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man that you marry?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Moran about her new book, How to Be a Woman. It's a bestseller in Britain. She's a columnist for the Times of London. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
Once again, the guest in this part of Focus is David Kaiser. He's professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he teaches in the program in science, technology, and society, and also the Department of Physics. And he is the author of a recent book. The title of his book is How the Hippies Saved Physics, subtitled Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. It's published by W.W. Norton. Now, I think we have restored we've done what we wanted to do from the beginning of the program. Here, through the mysteries of quantum entanglement, we have a much higher quality connection with David Kaiser. We couldn't get it going at the beginning, but I think we got it now. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
That's excellent. That's quantum right there.
There you go.
Okay. Well, so we're coming now to the point in the story where people are looking very seriously at this these parapsychological phenomena. There we have scientists who are saying, well, maybe there's some science here that can explain what's going on. And there were a lot of people who were doing continued work and looking at doing research. And I hear also another interesting turn the story takes when you look at who is funding the research. Now, in one respect, there still were people in government who were interested in this kind of thing, where before this might have been the Department of Defense, now it was people like the CIA who thought this might be something that could be applied to espionage.
That's right. In fact, they often joked it was called espionage, capital ESP, meaning could we in fact, spy on the Soviets or learn about, top secret installations using the power of mind, joined to these very exotic quantum phenomena like entanglement. So in fact, it was, as we now know, a lot of this work was only declassified in the mid-1990s, and then follow-up filings of Freedom of Information Act requests and so on have gotten, I think, a pretty clear picture, which was not at all clear at the time, that this work was being funded handily by the CIA and, in fact, by a branch of the Pentagon, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is a kind of like CIA post within the Pentagon. And between them, they were funding this sort of work for about roughly 20, 25 years, for about several tens of millions of dollars, at least, if you adjust for inflation and sort of current currencies. It was a real ongoing thing. And we also know, pardon me, we know that there were replication sites set up in many Army labs across the country. So the original protocol was being worked out at that Stanford Research Institute, or SRI, that I mentioned. But then some of those physicists were being hired to consult to help set up other efforts at places like the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland and elsewhere. And so this really was it was never on the scale of, you know, the next nuclear submarine or a bomber, but it was certainly substantial funding for a long time. And the group that I was writing about, they weren't the main recipients of that, but they were, many of them at least, became consultants. They were the kind of house theorists. The group at SRI were experimental physicists, and indeed by any measure highly qualified ones, but they weren't necessarily, you know, up to date on the latest still really not mainstream or not textbook developments like Bell's theorem or quantum entanglement. And so they often turned to members of this Berkeley group, this informal kind of ragtag discussion group, to try to puzzle through from first principles, you know, might there be a physical explanation for, you know, say the apparent mind-reading feats of some of their subjects.
Yeah, and this is, it may seem far-fetched, but I guess at the time almost anything and everything was at least on the table for exploration, and that what it appealed to the CIA was the notion, well, if such a thing was actually possible and you could find people who had that ability, then you might as well scrap all your U-2 planes because you're not going to need that anymore, because you could just have, if someone could actually do it, they could sit in a room at Langley, and by using their powers, they could see what was going on in the Soviet Union without having to go there.
Exactly. I mean, you could see the appeal, or at least the reason to say, well, this is a long shot, but it's worth, again, in their terms, a rather small amount of money, a kind of, you know, rounding error on their budgets, meaning, you know, several tens of millions of dollars, to at least, you know, check it out. And especially when some people started claiming, you know, positive results, then you could see how that could keep the money, you know, keep the money flowing.
Yeah. In addition, though, to there being government funding, I think perhaps what's even more interesting here is that some of the scientists who were interested in trying to get funding for this work went back to what might be thought of as a much earlier, much older kind of model, and that is they went to private philanthropists, people who found the work interesting or found the questions interesting, to provide some money. Certainly, and people in the Bay Area were interested. And one of the most important people turns out to be somebody who was at the time a very key figure in the human potential movement. This is a man I don't know when the last time I actually heard anybody mention this name, but I'm sure that probably a lot of people will remember Werner Erhard.
That's right. So Werner Erhard was by this point really by the early mid 70s, you know, a self-made millionaire. He had his EST training, Erhard Seminars training, had become really, you know, phenomenally popular. It was a national phenomenon within a few years, and certainly it started from his kind of headquarters in San Francisco. And he was in touch with many of these physicists in ways that, again, were no one could have seen that ahead of time. It was one of these kind of funny accidents of history that I had a lot of fun exploring in the book. And so, as it turns out, Erhard himself had been, you know, fascinated by modern physics as a kid. He read popular physics books in high school, and he'd been, you know, really, he admired the way that physicists could tackle, you know, very strange-seeming phenomena, but give a kind of discipline or rigor to try to understand it. I mean, Einstein's relativity sounds bizarre, at least on first hearing, and yet through the kind of power of reasoning these things through, Erhard realized these people could make sense of the world. And same with what he'd read about quantum theory. And in fact, you know, Werner Erhard was a name he assumed later in life, and he chose the name Werner in homage to Werner Heisenberg, you know, one of the great founders of quantum theory. So Erhard was already kind of interested in physics and quantum theory, and he met up in kind of funny ways with some of these core Berkeley physicists. And for a couple years, at least, they had a very close relationship, and Erhard was really extremely generous with funds from his kind of philanthropical foundation. And then he also helped set up, you know, other donors and connect them. So, in fact, other people who became very generous for the group included Michael Murphy, who was a co-director of the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, about 150 miles south of San Francisco, which, again, was sort of ground zero, epicenter for the kind of counterculture New Age movement. That's where people would go to learn about yoga and vegetarianism, which once seemed very exotic, and about Eastern spirituality, and also for quite some time about psychedelic drugs before they were even made illegal, and the greater notion of kind of the meaning or secrets of consciousness. I think that was the way to sort of sum them up? And was there a way to expand powers of mind, human potential, by understanding consciousness? And then people like Michael Murphy and Werner Erhard wondered if the latest breakthroughs in quantum physics might help in that endeavor.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, this place that we so much associate with this kind of New Age mysticism also was at one point a gathering place for scientists, these physicists who also came there and were tossing around all these ideas about the mystery of the world at the quantum level.
That's right. And so it really is, it was a great joy of mine to discover while doing research for the book, you know, that Esalen, which is so famous, as you say, for really, you know, I think many people would say far out stuff, that the single longest running seminar series in Esalen's history was on quantum theory and Bell's theorem. It just boggles the mind. It was this group that had a month long workshop in January of 1976, and that so impressed and so pleased Esalen's director, Michael Murphy, that he had them come back for week long workshops virtually every year for the better part of 20 years. It went for a very long time. And this was indeed one of the places where physicists would come to gather, a few physicists, not all, but those who were already kind of curious about Bell's theorem or about the wider kind of what does it all mean, the interpretation of quantum theory, that was one of the few places they could go on a regular basis to really hash out the details. Mm-hmm. So Richard Feynman, much beloved, you know, Nobel laureate, who at that point was at Caltech, he was in touch with this Berkeley group. He kept them kind of at arm's length. He was not particularly impressed, and he did not come to their workshops. But then he got in the act a few years later and started hosting his own workshops on the mysteries of quantum theory and bongo drumming and all the rest. So it really had this, Esalen really had for a while a very strong attraction to quantum physics and vice versa.
About 10, 12 minutes left in this hour of focus. Again, quickly let me tell you the guest is David Kaiser. He's professor of physics at MIT and is also the author of the book How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival, published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455 would be the number if you'd like to call in and you're here locally where we are, Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the number if it would be a long-distance call, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I did get an email from someone, and perhaps I should have done this a little bit earlier, someone who is saying, you know, there are certain physicists that we have all heard of, but they would like to know, could you give names to these hippie scientists and maybe say something about what they contributed as individuals to the field?
Sure, yeah. You know, one of the things that intrigued me was that not many of these folks, probably none of these folks, have sort of household names today. They're not even like, say, Richard Feynman, who has remarkable name recognition. It still amazes me, in fact. So perhaps the best well-known of this group, I would think, today was Fritjof Capra. And that name itself might not be so familiar, but he wrote the book called The Tao of Physics, which came out in 1975, and he was a core member of this group, and that was really helped kind of spur a resurgence of popular physics writing that would explore the kind of weird mysteries of modern physics. In Capra's case, it was explicitly in relation to Eastern spiritualism or Eastern mysticism. And so Capra's book became one of these runaway bestsellers. It was a sleeper hit, a kind of cult classic for a while, but then pretty quickly it caught fire. And so by this point, it's been, I think it's at latest count, something like 43 editions in 23 languages, you know, mega millions of copies in print, a real true publishing sensation. And so Capra was this sort of down on his luck, you know, PhD, he'd done postdocs and really well trained. He fell in with this group because he wanted to explore the deep mysteries of quantum theory, and so his book brought some of these ideas to a very, very wide audience, and it's still I think circulating today. Other folks might be better known to physicists. Probably the best known would be John Clauser, who's a remarkably gifted experimental physicist. In fact, he conducted the world's very first experimental test of Bell's theorem, the first laboratory test to see could particle A really be affected by what happened to, say, particle B or vice versa. And he was doing that as a postdoc at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. And as John recounts, sort of he grudgingly got his postdoc supervisor to let him kind of spend or waste half his time on this pet obsession of his, because it wasn't what he was hired to do. And the only folks whom John could find interested in this stuff were the other members of this discussion group that he was very avidly participating in, this fundamental physics group. Since we all have learned to take Bell's theorem so seriously, John has begun to win the recognition that he clearly deserved all the way back then. And so he was widely rumored to be in the contention for the Nobel Prize this past year. Maybe he'll win next year. So among scientists, Clauser's name certainly is better known. And then a lot of the others, they're really not very well known today. And that's part of what was sort of the rags to riches to rags, kind of part of the story, that these folks were incredibly active in pushing along questions that now, we take very seriously. They were wrong more often than they were right, as sort of all of us are. It's not that all their answers turned to gold, but they were putting a question on the agenda. They were pushing. They really knew how to calculate. They were coming up with really very fascinating challenges, like thought experiments, to say, if Bell's theorem is right, could we send signals faster than the speed of light? Could we, where do the joints meet? How do we make quantum theory really compatible with Einstein's relativity? And that was serious work. That was work that we have come to benefit from, even though we've largely forgotten who was kind of pushing it along in the early days.
Yeah. You talked about how some of these ideas got introduced into the popular culture with books like Tao of Physics or Gary Zukav's book Dancing Woolly Masters. And certainly there are a lot of articles written in popular magazines. It was much tougher to get papers on dealing with these subjects into the mainstream physics journals. And so here again, scientists turn to some non-traditional avenues. And here again another odd, strange figure comes into the story. This is a man named Ira Einhorn. Maybe someone will remember him for the fact that he later became famous or infamous for having been accused of murdering his girlfriend and then running away to Europe, where he lived under an assumed name for something like 16 years, and he was finally caught him and brought him back, and he is now serving a life sentence in prison here in the United States. But he was a very important figure in the anti-war movement and the counterculture before that, and was really instrumental in getting, again, some of these ideas to circulate.
He really was another one of these kind of off-scale personalities about whom I really hadn't known much before I started digging into the book, but fascinating person. And Einhorn had gone to University of Pennsylvania. He was native of Philadelphia, and he had had a very early interest in physics as well. And then he switched over to English literature and dabbled in grad school for a while, and was sort of a intellectual type. And then, as you say, became very, very involved with the anti-war movement in the late 60s. I think very, very courageous, in fact, and was often seen helping to organize these massive rallies that we might remember with people like Abby Hoffman and that crowd, Jerry Rubin. And then by the early 70s, Einhorn's interests had turned back, so to speak, or had turned squarely to physics, and then also to, again, things we might call the occult or parapsychology or the sort of wider range of kind of where physics might lead. And Einhorn, through a kind of fascinating series of relationships, was able he became a center, a node in a worldwide distribution, the sort that we take for granted today in the age of email and the internet. But he was doing this with sort of postage stamps and mimeograph machines or Xerox machines, and he was circulating newspaper clippings and press releases and formal preprints full of equations from physicists to hundreds and hundreds of people around the world, even Eastern Bloc countries and so on, including Nobel laureates in the United States in physics and parapsychology enthusiasts and sort of everyone in between. And so he became enamored of this members of this Berkeley group. He thought what they were doing on physics and its possible implications for, say, the nature of consciousness, that was really incredibly important. And so he had this sort of incredible flourishing network, and he sort of got their stuff into circulation. And that's a large way of how some of these very kind of elaborate, complicated thought experiments, calculations that these Berkeley physicists were doing to try to figure out the end point of entanglement. Where might this lead? That's how those got into the hands of illustrious physicists around the world, most of whom had not asked to be put on Ira Einhorn's mailing list. They just got the stuff in the mail, and then, at least as they recall, they usually shoved most of it right to the waste paper bin. But sometimes these things kind of they landed. They got picked up. And so, again, it was a kind of end run around the usual communication system that we might expect.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point where we maybe have about 5 minutes left. To return just for a moment to Bell's theorem, which you explained a little bit earlier, was this idea that it, at one time was kind of marginal and now is much more widely accepted, the idea that you could have two particles, that some kind of connection would be established between the two particles, and then you could separate them by a vast distance, and yet if you do something to one of them, it will affect the other. Has anyone really tried to come up with some sort of serious explanation as to just what the mechanism here is, how that could happen, how that could be?
You know, it's the right question to ask, and I'm gonna give you a bad answer. I think many of my colleagues in physics have tried very hard to come up with explanations. In fact, there are many clever ones and lots of delightful, sort of accessible essays that are metaphorical, right? But I think we'd all have to say we don't have a mechanism. We don't have a kind of this gear turns and leads to that outcome over there. It is indeed something that the equations of quantum theory unambiguously predict. And it was really John Bell's great contribution to show that this is not something we can take or leave. If we believe the structure of quantum theory, the governing equations, then we can't escape this sort of effect. And then people like John Clauser, and then by this point, many, many more, Alain Aspé and Anton Zeilinger and many, many physicists around the world since Clauser's path-breaking work have subjected to that notion to really, really ingenious laboratory tests, trying to close every conceivable loophole and control for this and that. And like it or not, they find this kind of these long-distance correlations that have no possible explanation, that at least that people have convincingly come up with otherwise. But that's all different from saying I can picture in my mind's eye exactly what causes this to happen across space and time, because I often say it's an insult to our intuition. It's just not how we think the world's supposed to work, and that's why it's, I think, especially juicy. And in fact, part of what was so exciting about this stuff today is it's not just something to ponder. It certainly is that. But people are actually putting that to work in real-world devices all the time, and in this flourishing field known as quantum information science rests on the fact that Bell's theorem holds, even if we can't give a kind of point-by-point explanation as it unfolds in a kind of intuitive sense. Mm. So the entire subject of quantum encryption rests on the fact that quantum entanglement is just a fact of the world, near as we can tell. A lot of the advances in quantum computing, again, take advantage of these so-called entangled states. That's step one. And so we have reason to believe it really is how the world works. And then we might still indeed come up with valiant efforts and metaphors and analogies that are very clever, that aren't quite the same thing as I think what you're really pushing for.
Yeah, it's both the explanation and the question that you went on to answer, and as for somebody like me who would say, well, that's quite interesting, and I think maybe a little bit I understand what you're talking about. What good is it? What can you do with it? There are, in fact, things that you can do with it that are pretty important and interesting.
People are doing honestly, it feels like magic. It's astonishing. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, many, many, many university campuses across the United States, around the world, private, corporate laboratories, government laboratories. This is a flourishing, flourishing field. MIT recently started its own graduate program just in this area called quantum information science at the border between physics and mathematics and computer science and electrical engineering. It's fascinating work and attracting a lot of, very, very bright young students. And it's partly because people really can do stuff with it. It really seems to be on the cusp of perhaps a real engineering breakthrough.
Yeah.
And to trace that back to say, where did those ideas, find their most natural home, say, 40 years ago or 35 years ago, it looks awfully different than what we're accustomed to today.
Yeah. Here, I want to pose this question. I think it's really unfair for me to say, and I can give you a minute and a half, but someone asked this question by email that I think is kind of interesting. Poses the question, do you believe that physics is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, or at least that physics can explain what we don't know about the world, or do you think physics is just one tool and we haven't found the other ways to explain the unexplainable yet?
Well, that's a tough one. I have a minute and a half. Huh? Okay, that's no problem.
No problem.
Here's my two-word answer. Yeah. I'll say this. Part of what continues to attract me to the field and gets, I mean, when I find my, I just lose myself in the joy of calculation or of teaching and working with young students who are getting up to speed with that, it's that we really can explain and understand things now that we didn't think we could possibly hope to explain just a generation or two ago. That doesn't mean we'll always conquer, you know, every last thing and physics will end and we'll have answered everything altogether. But if we look back and say we just didn't know, say, you know, why there are clusters of galaxies or, you know, big, beautiful questions about the way the world and the universe hang together, and now we have, you know, pretty good answers, not all of them, and we can subject them to increasingly, you know, ingenious tests and make adjustments. And so I'd say it depends on what you're measuring against. Is it the ultimate where we're going to answer everything and sew it up in a bow? Probably not. At least, probably not this week. But the quest sure is. It continues to be incredibly exciting. And if you look back, you know, 10, 20, 50, or 100 years, I think it's safe to say we've conquered a lot of terrain that looked like it would only be hopelessly mysterious, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. Well, there's lots more to this story. A lot of great characters. So folks might want to pursue it further by taking a look at the book I mentioned here now several times. The title of the book is How the Hippies Saved Physics. The subtitle is Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. Published by W.W. Norton, by our guest, David Kaiser. He's professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he teaches in the program in Science, Technology, and Society and the Department of Physics. We also want to make a special thank you to the technical folks there on the other end of our high-quality connection here with MIT, Craig Milanese and Clayton Hainsworth. Thanks to them. And to you, Professor Kaiser, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Interest rates are at record lows. While that's good news for some, it's a source of frustration for others.
You know, they tell you to save money, to save for your retirement and the future or what have you, and doing that seems kind of a waste because we can't even keep up with inflation.
The upsides and downsides of low interest rates later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, featuring Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're heading into the last few hours of trading for this particular day. Soybean futures continue to slide lower, seeing follow-through on yesterday's weaker day as investors continue to take profits on gains and look at weather maps, which are indicating scattered rain showers moving across the soybean belt. Meanwhile, the yield numbers continue to work their way lower for new crop, with FC Stone putting in yesterday their estimate for next Friday's WASDE report at a yield per acre at 38.2 and a total crop at 2.73 billion bushels. Meanwhile, when you looked at the export sales today, many traders looked at the new crop and deemed them disappointing, with only 52,400 metric tons sold for the marketing year that begins on September 1st. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. We'll begin in that soybean pit, where August is now 1647 and a half, down 34 and three quarters. September, 1620, down 18 and three quarters. November, 1612 and a half, now 12 and a